listening to Community Spotlight on Gila Members Community Radio, Kuru 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, and online at gmcr.org. Our purpose is to enhance public awareness of our featured nonprofit or advocacy organizations in Grant County and surrounding area. I'm Candace Burke, your weekly host. Joining me today is Mike Fugali. Mike is a conservation biologist, ornithologist, and climate reality leader. He currently manages the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance's Climate Justice and Youth Empowerment Program, Thinking on a Mountain, and he's also the Youth Conservation Corps Eco-Monitoring Supervisor at Elder Leopold Charter School. Welcome to Community Spotlight, Mike.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
It's great to have you here. Well, I want you to talk to us all about this incredible work you're doing in our community. So, you know, starting with starting with what you're doing with not just the Thinking on a Mountain, but also as the Youth Conservation Eco-Monitoring Supervisor. So take it away, Mike. What can you tell us?
Oh, gosh. Well, let's see. I guess I'll start with the Eco-Monitors because we're in the midst of our extended learning program right now at Elder Leopold Charter School. We have a 10-day post-in-classroom, early summer outdoor, you know, experience for the kids right now. I have 16 kids that we're taking out to the Gila River, to the Iron Bridge Preserve mostly. And boy, are they learning birds. You know, it's the reason that I do it, I guess, is because the Gila River affords to us this really special opportunity to immerse young people in a really charismatic and wild and highly biodiverse landscape. And it gets them out of their own. And sometimes you might laugh, but instead of calling it eco-monitoring, I call it ego-monitoring, because I'm emphasizing to these kids that what we're doing is we're looking at the external world. And right now, a lot of kids are really focused on the internal world, which is fine and good. But, you know, I remind them that we're at a really critical moment in history and that, you know, every generation wants to think of themselves as special. But their generation really is special. They're the ones that have to help us. Although it's unfair to them, they have a heavy burden of trying to solve our climate and ecological crises.
They really do. It is a heavy burden. I think about what they must be processing with all of this. What feedback do you get from these kids? What do they say to you?
You know, I guess the first thing that I would say is that it's amazing how resilient they are. A lot of kids, when they come to understand what the Anthropocene represents, you know, our new ecological or geological epoch, when they understand that the role of, well, first, let me just go back and say that I think about this in really two ways. There's the science, you know. Hardly anybody really understands the science of what's really going on right now. It's certainly not taught very heavily in the schools. And young people, I believe, are suffering a grave injustice because they're just not informed of the reality of this moment in time. And so that's one of my jobs. It's one of my hardest jobs, is to compassionately and intelligently let these young people know that they no longer have a buffer like we did. We, you know, 30 years ago, when we really started to understand that our environment was in serious trouble, we could look ahead at this moment in time. And that's not true for these young people. These young people are emerging into a planetary crisis. And it takes a lot of love and compassion and knowledge to help these kids through that understanding and to send them on a life course that is restorative and regenerative and focused on the need ahead.
And they're really lucky to have your guidance, Mike, I'll tell you that.
Well, thanks.
Now, am I having a visual hallucination, or did I see Gordon West just walk behind you?
Yes, as a matter of fact, yeah, that's behind me is one of his biochar energy units, the famous Charbecue. And I'm up here at Gila WoodNet because, you know, I know we're going to talk a lot about the New Earth Project. Very wonderful thing going on in my life personally and hopefully in the community. And we're incubated up here at Gila WoodNet with Gordon's help supplying the biomass for our composting project. So I'm here today to fill number 37. Number 37, which is the last bioreactor in this pilot project. I just ground up the last food waste coming from the elementary schools that we're partnering with, Jose Barrios, Harrison Schmidt, and Stout. And Carol Ann and Nan are going to be up here in about an hour, and we're going to fill number 37. We might name it Wilbur because it has so much ham in it from the school lunches. And that represents for us about 12 tons of food, which has been collected locally in this pilot project period, these last two semesters from the schools. 12 tons of food that instead of going to the landfill are now turning into a really important restoration product, a soil inoculant called Johnson Soup Compost.
Well, that's fascinating. You know, yeah. I was wondering, can you still hear me pretty well? My face is doing, we having a visual here. I think Gordon was the vector of this.
Gordon always, he always shifts space-time when he walks by.
He does. There's always that space-time continuum with him. But what else can you tell us about what's going on at the Old Chinese Gardens? I hear there's some pretty exciting stuff you're doing down there.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot going on down there. There's, you know, finally a partnership with, I think it's Food Hub, and I can't remember the name of, you know, their larger name. But we're going to get some hoop houses down there, growing some local produce in a more significant way soon. There's, you know, Gordon with his CIG grant, working with his partners on the Navajo Nation and up in Cleveland. They're about to get their greenhouse put up here that's going to be, you know, an aquaculture powered by a biochar energy unit like the one kind of you see behind me over here. So really neat things going on. And I'm really focused down there on permaculture and food forest regeneration along the creek. And so the San Vicente Creek Restoration Project that is being spearheaded right now by GRIP, Gila Resources Information Project, under Allison Civic, has allowed us to plant about 300 new native plants down there along the creek on that old floodplain. And we're doing that with the help of young people. And we're doing that. It's a personal goal. You know, I have a personal goal of, because I have a membership in the Old Chinese Gardens LLC, I have a personal goal of working over a longer period of time than most people have a chance to see a real forest, food forest community being born down there in a restoration forest that multiple years of kids can work on. And, you know, the optimism of putting plants in the ground and the importance of putting trees in the ground couldn't be higher right now. And so, you know, when we're talking about stewardship and acting as a keystone species and all the things that young people have to understand when they think about us moving from the passenger seat to the driver's seat of the car right now.
And, you know, you talk for our listeners who don't know much about biochar and what you're doing in terms of in restoring that area. What can you share with our listeners?
I think biochar is an interesting soil amendment that I have a lot of hope to experiment with our new compost. And I know, you know, for us in our project, I mean, biochar has a lot of wonderful uses. For our project, we're trying to see if it can carry the really fungally diverse microbiotic community that we're creating in our composters, in our bioreactors, to see if the biochar, with its ability to house microorganisms and its ability to hold water, will be an important component of that soil inoculant as we move forward with testing and that type of thing. I already think that in our bioreactors, they're really interesting. You know, it took us a while to figure out how to do this. The big challenge, and let me kind of concentrate on this for a minute, because this is interesting, and that all over the world, people are starting to do this Johnson Tsuh composting. And the reason that they're doing it is because it has huge, huge potential for carbon sequestration. And so the biochar might be a way to make this final product, this final inoculant, a more effective inoculant. And that's what we're really focusing on. You know, we have 30, we're going to end up with 38 bioreactors. That's going to give us enough at 2 pounds per acre, which doesn't sound very much, does it? Because it's an extract of microorganisms, not really the compost. So we can potentially, even with this small pilot project, treat over 10,000 acres of land and restore that much land in terms of restoring the mycelial network that represents so much sequestration.
This is pretty phenomenal. This truly is.
Yeah, it's a really big deal. Matter of fact, we were just on the phone the other day with a famous scientist named Stuart Kaufman from the Santa Fe Institute, you know, one of those real systems theories thinkers that just gave an opening talk at TED 2023. And what do you think he was talking about? Johnson Tsuh composting and the potential of this technology as a climate solution.
Wow. So, okay, that's yeah, cool.
We're really, you know, we have a lot to prove and a lot to, learn, but we feel like we're part of something really sort of cutting edge with the biochar and with the compost itself.
And, you know, again, our community is so lucky, Mike, to have you and Carol Ann part of this. I mean, like I said, I don't even think this episode's going to cover all the things that the two of you do.
Well, it's weird for us because, you know, we'd homesteaded for years out in the Gila Valley. We're both ornithologists. We love being alone in the woods. That's what Carol and I love more than anything in the world. And for us to be so involved in a community project like this is actually a little bit out of character. You know, but our lives as conservation biologists and our understanding of what's happening to the planet has sort of forced us into this, responsibility that we feel to, you know, help the next generation solve this problem. We certainly, you know, they have all the power in terms of their ethical position, but they don't have any power in terms of creating solutions at this point. And so I think that we feel a really weighty responsibility to not only help these people or these young people and future generations adapt to climate change, but we have to use these last few years while we still have human agency to mitigate climate change. And that's what we're talking about, mm-hmm. is getting this carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and stabilizing this catastrophe and hopefully helping these young people turn the corner back towards a livable planet.
You're so right. I mean, time is of the essence right now. We are looking, is so imminent. We have no idea.
Right. And, you know, we think about that as a science thing, but you have to think about that as an ethical thing, too. What does it mean to say that young people and future generations, even if we did everything right, everything we could possibly do right, that would still give them probably less than a 50% chance of not having a planet that has irreversible, catastrophic planetary change? And so, I mean, it's like we're already in Vegas and we're already losing. And instead of caring for the seventh generation, like the Iroquois Confederacy, we're not even caring for the first generation.
I'm really glad you could say that. I think that's really, really important. You're stressing that. And it's a conversation that I have every day with George and friends. This is critical. It's so critical. Now, I'm looking, I was talking to you earlier before we started airing, and you have this this really cool T-shirt on. And as an orthodontist, you got to share with our listeners what you're wearing.
Yes, let's see. This is, this may have been, I think this was a gift many years ago by Dr. Dale Zimmerman, who really phenomenal person that has changed really Kieran Mai's life by gifting his house to us and giving us really the opportunity to do what we're doing. So anyway, this is a Mexican duck. It used to be federally listed as endangered, and it was the reason that the Gila bird habitat area, you know, was protected in the first place, that lower reach of the Cliff Gila Valley, sort of that isolated special valley that nobody goes to. Man, if it was in California, you'd have to pay $75 parking and $100 camping fee. But it's, you know, just you can go down there and be alone at one of the most wild, spectacular spots that, you know, I can wish to be. So anyway, that area was protected. The Mexican duck finally lost its federal protection because the taxonomist decided that it was just a subspecies or something of mallard duck. So it was no longer considered a unique taxonomic entity that deserved protection. But the aura of the bird habitat area was already there. And so then the willow flycatcher was listed, and the yellow-billed cuckoo, and the loach minnow, and the spiked dace. And so the bird habitat area transformed into really a protected area for a suite of endangered species that are really thriving down there now.
Well, you know, I have been reading so much lately about the health benefits of birding, watching and being around birds. And I totally get it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when we go down to the river and we show young people birds, and Carol and I have done a lot of mist netting in the past as part of our work. And we've had an opportunity to show, you know, essentially jewels, you know, we can talk about birds and you can listen to them. But when you actually see them up close, it can be transformative for young people to understand that those just aren't these things flitting around. These are individuals. They have cloacal protuberances and brood patches, and they have, you know, families, and they come back to the same spot year after year after year. You know, when Thoreau said that wilderness is a civilization other than our own, you know, this is proof of it. You go down there and you see this bird community on the river that is a civilization, and these kids are entering it just for a short period of time, and it's really changing their lives, I think.
It's just magical. As Anne of Green Gables, it's magical and romantical.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I love it down there. It's so fun that that preserve that we're working on, the Iron Bridge Preserve, owned by the state and the Nature Conservancy, over the last 15 years has gone from a barren landscape because of cattle impacts, where really nothing grew along the river besides seep willow or mule fat. And now there's a brand new cottonwood willow forest, and the whole suite of species that you want there are there. And so there's this really dramatic confrontation right now between the restorative energy when the impact was removed, and of course, the pressure now of climate change. The whole landscape is getting hotter. These birds can only breed in moist, high humidity environments that you get under the leaves of deciduous trees over moist soils and beaver ponds. But still, the temperature is going up, and a lot of these birds might have trouble in the future. But, you know, anyway, there's that back and forth between those two forces.
You know, you mentioned earlier how one of the things you love most is just being alone out in the forest.
Right.
What is that ritual like for you? What are some of your experiences out there?
Oh, gosh. Some of my favorite ones. I remember, you know, when I did a lot of spotted owl work. So you just start at dusk. You'd walk out to your first call point. Oftentimes, the furthest call point from the car, you'd try to get there just as the sun set. And then, you know, you'd work back towards the car in sort of 0.4-mile increment over the course of the night. And some of my favorite moments are those dusk moments when you get out of that to that farthest point. And I can tell you two of them. One of them, and they're both up in the Jemez, where I worked for some time, up in the Carson National Forest. One was wild horses. I walked up this mountain, got up to the very top of this ridge, and there was a big group of wild horses there, including this stallion. And it was like a black stallion with a bolt of electricity, like a lightning bolt, right down its head, forehead. And he came within maybe 30 feet of me, and the rest of them formed like a hat. The rest of them had run off into the woods. But then when he stayed, they all came back and made a big half circle around him. And he huffed at me and kind of stomped and, you know, just was a very intimidating presence for about 5 minutes. And then he kind of gave some signal to the group and they all turned around and fled into the woods. So that was pretty neat.
That is. It's almost like comparable to seeing unicorns in a way.
Yeah. Oh, it was unbelievable. And then another one is I was, you know, walking up that mountain at dusk, trying to get to my first spot before the sun went down. And I was really out of breath. I had a pretty heavy pack on and I wasn't really paying much attention, but I kept hearing something over to my left. And I finally looked over and just 10 feet from me was a huge bear, And it was a big mama bear digging in the earth at a root stump. And the shavings from the stump were just flying, you know, 10, 20 feet into the air. And I was so close and right next to her with her head still buried in the hole, right next to her was her 3 to 4 foot cub that was standing straight upright, just like a person, and was just looking at me. And, you know, I had a camera, but no way was I going to stop. I just walked by quietly. And that little cub just looked at me as I walked by, and the mother never, she was so into what she was doing, she never even picked her head up out of the ground, but I was lucky.
You were so like, I'm so glad she was preoccupied.
Yeah, right.
What else would you like to share, share before we wrap up today's show? I know there's so much more I want to ask you, so I'll have to have you back on, but what else would you like our listeners to know about your work?
Well, I guess, you know, I guess the thing that I really focus on that has drawn my my attention is the idea, is the ethical part of this catastrophe, you know, this move into the Anthropocene. It's not only a physical thing, it's an ethical thing. It really changes what it means to be human. And, you know, I think the work with young people is what draws me the most, because I can see that they are being not only harmed, but they are being harmed constitutionally. They are being harmed. They're losing their right to life and liberty. The ability, the possibilities of their futures are diminishing. They're losing their property. I mean, it's a real what you could consider to be a crime. And I'm very, very hopeful that a lot of your listeners might turn into, boy, I wish I had it at the tip of my tongue here. But it's the Our Children's Trust climate lawsuit in Montana in June. It's going to be the first climate lawsuit in the United States where climate change and the science of climate change is going to be allowed into the courts. It's going to be fascinating and important. And I hope everybody follows this, you know, this ethical story, because this really is the story of our time.
It truly is. And what kind of contact information can you give us about this?
Other than all I can tell you is go to Our Children's Trust online. Yeah. And okay. It'll be highlighted.
Now,
they're a great group.
They sound like they are. I'm really glad you could mention them. And also, any immediate future projects you have going? Anything else you want to say as we say
goodbye? Well, what I'd like to just let everybody know that, you know, we did this project as a pilot project. It was a grant awarded by the Commission for Environmental Cooperation for their Environmental Justice for Climate program. And it was a 2-year program, and it was beyond successful. We thought we were going to do 28 reactors. We're going to end up with 38, and they seem to be working perfectly. In other words, the idea of using using food waste and mixing it with forest biomass as the input into Johnson Sioux composting seems to be the first of its kind and seems to be successful. So we've made a personal decision, our group, our staff, that we're going to try to seek funding, community support, and everything else to make this permanent. And so hopefully in the fall, we'll be opening up when school starts, and we'll have a permanent composting project here in Silver City.
This is most excellent. Mike, I can't thank you enough for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you.
I look forward to having you back. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Community Spotlight on Gila Members Community Radio, Kuru 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, and online at gmcr.org. Community Spotlight airs every Thursday at 10:30 a.m. and on Sundays at 11:30 a.m. It is also available online at gmcr.org. I'm Candace Burke. Thanks for listening.